we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene, and tonight Simon is with me. Good evening, Simon.
Good evening.
And we're going to be taking a look at the 1960s series The Prisoner, the second episode, arguably, The Chimes of Big Ben. And I just want to apologize to everyone before we get started. I'm a little bit under the weather, so you may hear that my voice is a little bit feeble tonight, but I will try to compensate as best I possibly can. So last time, as I recall, you had not actually seen The Prisoner.
That's right.
So this is...
Well, I had certainly not seen it for a long time, and I'd probably not seen that episode.
Okay. And so now we're moving on to second. And when I said, you know, arguably second episode, there is a whole bunch of different orders that these have been played in, depending on where they play. We are going by the original UK air date, which is, as best we can tell, as close as Patrick McGoohan wanted it as he could. So, and this is his baby, so... We'll try to go with
at this stage. It makes no difference. But the air date and even the air date and the original ITC intended order do deviate at some point. So we're going to have to make a decision down the line of which way we go with that when we come to it.
Yeah. I have a book. I have a volume of books, The Prisoner Scripts, which is a fascinatingly well researched. Little piece of book that has all the scripts. It has some unused scripts, and it has lots of footnotes and revisions and corrections and changes, and it's a very interesting read. And I've got a few pieces of information from there that I'm going to include in on the podcast this evening, including one which I promise you is the mildest of spoilers that will not in any way ruin anything to do with the show, but I realized it at the last moment that it's just a tiny, tiny one. It has to do with a returning actor who comes back in another episode. One of the guest artists is in another episode, and I'll make mention of it because it's interesting why the character came back later on.
Go
ahead.
Do the books say anything about the mystery of the order of the episodes?
They don't, actually. I went and took a look just this morning to see if I could find a specific thing, but they are in a particular order, and this one is the second one, so it's not production order, and it is a British book, so I'm guessing it's probably either air date or ITC intended air date.
Well, those are both the same, at least for the first eight episodes, so we won't have any problem with that. And next time we talk about The Prisoner, it'll therefore be the episode A, B, and C,
yes.
Presumably.
Yes. We'll start up here with a brief, or perhaps not so brief, summary of the episode. The Prisoner does not lend itself to the shortest of summaries, I've noticed. The new number two looks on as number six prepares breakfast, typically defiantly. Number two joins number six at a chess game later in the day as a helicopter arrives carrying a beautiful woman. They continue the interview later. Number six is typically defiant. Number two explains that the girl is the new number eight. The old number eight is gone. They watch on as number eight, like number six before her, wakes up in her own apartment, but now in the village. Number two repeats number six's introduction to the village. Number two also tries to interest number six in joining in an arts exhibition being held in the village. Later, number six meets number eight and takes her to the Green Dome. He clearly doesn't trust her. She pleads all she did was resign. He is disinterested. Later, he invites her in for a nightcap and asks her questions. She doesn't trust him either. She is an Estonian, and she has clearly heard of the village before. She reveals her name to be Nadia. The next day, she attempts to escape by swimming out to sea, while number two explains to number six that the village is his blueprint for a better world. Back at the Green Dome, number two reviews number eight's file and sees that she was an Olympic bronze medalist swimmer. They scan her out at sea and send Rover to bring her back. She is taken to hospital. Later, they call number six to hospital, where number eight is being psychologically tortured. First, she attempts to escape, but then decides to let herself be killed. Number two shows genuine panic when he thinks she'll die. Number six demands her release. He agrees to collaborate. He'll settle down and even enter the art contest if they let her go. Number two is incredulous, but amusedly agrees. In the morning, they seem to be settling into a familiar, almost familial pattern. They go to the woods where Number Six has made stone tools and will start making his abstract art for the art show. He grills her about what she knows about the village and where it is. He says if he knew where they were, he could sail out of there. She must think it over. With his stone tools, he fells a tree and begins his woodwork. That night she comes to him, and they pretend to be in love, and she reveals that they are in Lithuania, near the Polish border. She says she wants to hear the chimes of Big Bill. He corrects her, and she says that she'll never call him anything except Big Ben. At the art show, all the artwork is of Number Two, except for Number Six's, which is an abstract piece. The judges are confused. Number Six explains about his piece, called Escape, with a bunch of gobbledygook. Clearly, Number Two influences the judges into awarding it to Number Six. He uses his award money to buy Number 38's tapestry of Number Two. Later that night, Number Six and Number Eight take the artwork to the shore, assemble it into a sailboat, and unfurl the tapestry as the sail. They get 30 miles near their destination when Number Two sends Rover after them. They dive overboard and swim for the shore. An observer on the shore shoots a rifle at Rover, which backs off. The observer is Nadia's contact and helps them smuggle themselves to London. During the journey, he uses a watch taken from Nadia's associate to keep track of the journey. It is apparent that Number Eight is interested in Number Six. In the London offices of Fotheringay, a colleague of Number Six's from the old days, they have received Number Six's coded message and are awaiting him. They bounce awake as they are deposited in Fotheringay's office and uncrated. He is surrounded by familiar faces, including the Colonel. They hear Big Ben chime the half hour. The Colonel questions Number Six privately. The Colonel feigns ignorance of the village, but Number Six doesn't believe him. The Colonel doesn't believe Number Six isn't a double agent. Number Six is indignant and tries to convince himself that our side is different from the others. The Colonel demands an explanation from Number Six. He starts with questions. Why did he resign? With a guarantee of safety for the girl, he agrees to explain why he resigned. But as he starts to explain, Big Ben strikes eight, the same time as the Polish watch shows. Realization dawning, Number Six uncovers a tape recorder playing the sounds of traffic. He walks out the front door and into the village. The Colonel, Fotheringay, and Nadia are all watching Number Six as he returns to his cage. So I'm particularly pleased with doing them in, we had a variety of orders to choose from, and I'm going to put it on the table. I've always liked this episode of The Prisoner, so I was happy that this one came out, because it was another alternative one that I'm not as crazy about, but I thought this was a good one, and I'm curious as to what your reaction to it, because this is not my favorite, but it's up there quite a lot. I think this one's got a lot of layers to it that are quite intriguing. So what did you think of it?
Well, before I say what I thought of the episode itself, just touching on the question of the order, I'm interested to watch them in some sort of order, in the sense that there must be some intention behind this from the point of view of thinking, even though we know that certainly in those days the networks would mess things around and reorder the episodes, and in some cases different ITV regions would show them in different orders, and certainly the differences between the UK and US air dates meant that they were shown in different orders.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that there might be some, if not an arc running through the stories in the way that we understand story arcs now, at least some kind of logical progression, makes it interesting to see how, after last week's episode, which clearly was an introductory episode, it did the whole setup, it set everything out and established the village, and then in the last few minutes crammed a bit of an extra story in on top, how they would pick up from that, because obviously we had Number Six trying to make an escape. But we're left with the question of how is he going to cope with his failure in that. You know, he didn't get away from the village, so in some way he's going to have to face up to, at least in the short term, for the immediate future, life in the village.
Uh-huh.
So episode two, in a sense, has to pick that up and address it. And I think it's quite interesting in this episode that we see him. We get some introductions to the setup that are clearly there to remind people, because it's been a week since the episode's broadcast, but also presumably to let in those new viewers who didn't see it.
Oh, yes,
last
yes,
time.
Yes. That's it. That's the beginning of every episode.
Okay.
Except for so, two, I think, but for special reasons. But yeah.
Right. But we get this thing of number two is watching him in the kitchen in the morning, and he says, he even makes the act of putting on a dressing gown appear a gesture of defiance. And you get this very contained performance from McGowan, and he puts the speaker in the fridge. Mm-hmm. He's very calm, he's very measured, but he's also very deliberate and quite, I suppose, in a sense, that's quite a subversive act in the context. And you see number two's reaction to it. You know, he's going to make him break. He insists that he's going to get him to tell them one thing, and that's going to be it. So within that, you get the whole, you get the prisoner set up almost, I think, better than in episode one, where it was all spelled out and made very explicit. But it's so economical, I suppose, at the start of this episode. I thought that was really interesting.
And they do, it is the same intro every time, except that they cut in a different number two, or if they have a different actor for number two.
Oh, right. So he's always making breakfast.
Two, right. The opening kind of...
Or he's always being watched doing something
the intro,
on the screen.
The introductory segment where they go through that sort of dance with, what is this place, the village, who are you, that would be telling
oh,
is number
yes,
one, all
yes.
that. That's all the same, but it's also recut for each number two at the beginning of every
yeah.
episode. So,
but after that, when you do get this short sequence of kind of life. He's living life in his house, and number two and his assistant, who did he spot was Henry Gordon Jago?
I did. In fact, I have some interesting trivia about that. For that, he this episode was shot later on, and if you'll notice that Christopher Benjamin was also in the pilot.
Oh, I didn't spot that.
He was the agent that supposedly jumped out the window.
All right.
So they redubbed him in this one because when they changed the order, they didn't want it to be the same character. So it's actually not his voice. It's a different voice actor.
I wondered, because he has got such a distinctive voice.
Right.
And it didn't... He looks much younger. He can't be that much younger than when the talons of Wang Chang was shot. But he looks... younger,
years,
and so I thought maybe his voice hadn't kind of matured to that very kind of full, distinctive voice that we kind of are familiar with now.
No, just it was a voice actor that redid the voice for him, for presumably, and they don't actually have a definitive reason, but presumably because they had put those two episodes up back to back to each other.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense though. It's a relatively inconspicuous part,
and there were quite a few lines cut from his character as well. The script book has a lot of they're not important lines, but you know, longer sequences of dialogue about how they're going to try to crack him, or will they crack him, and that just basically they removed them. They weren't necessary, but I think it made it easier to disguise the fact that it was the same actor.
Well, I don't think the edits harm it at any rate.
No, I don't think so. And the other thing I'll say is that number two in this episode is played by Leo McKern, who is he's Rumpel of the Bailey, isn't he?
Yeah, I was going to say Rumpel.
Yeah. So he's quite well known, or he will be quite well known. He's been in lots of different shows over the years. He had a fractious relationship with Patrick McGowan, apparently, on the set. And yet, McGowan specifically asked to bring him back as number two in the next episode that was to be filmed, which was at the time Degree Absolute, which got renamed to Once Upon a Time and got pushed further back. But it's just interesting. I think he's the only number two to be in it twice.
Certainly he's the name I associate with number two, with my... And I was wondering, had I seen this episode? And I had no recollection of having seen it, but I was almost certain that I had seen McKern as number two.
I take it back. There is another actor who plays number two twice, but it's clear he's not the same man either. So it's the very different personalities.
That's interesting.
So, and who knows whether that's intentional or whether that's just part of the game that they're playing with the audience. Anyway,
the other thing in terms of the sort of continuity or the ongoing development of the story is that I would say some time does seem to have passed since his arrival, since number six's arrival in the village, because he. It still feels like early days, but he's become established and he's become. I won't say he's conformed entirely, but he's
playing the game.
He's playing the game exactly. He's playing the game and he's living village life. He's greeting the other villagers, and quite significantly, I thought, and I wondered why actually he said this, but he does say to Nadia, number eight, that when she asks what his name is, he says, sorry, I don't have one. I'm number six.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, no name. Why does he say that?
I think it's distrust. I think he doesn't want to be on a first name basis with her. You know, I think Patrick McGoohan, who is apparently quite the strong-willed man and quite difficult and but had a vision on this show, and I will give him this. He is a hell of an actor, and he can, throughout these episodes, he can, with this look, convey this sort of, I'm playing a game, I know you're playing a game, it's deadly yes. serious, but at the same time, I'm going to play it, and I'm going to beat you. And he's great at that. And I don't mean he's a good actor. I mean, I've seen him in other things, and he's turned in excellent performances. I'm not conveying it just to that, but it really comes across in The Prisoner, this very odd way that he contains himself. It's I think we mentioned before, it's such a measured amount of emotion that he shows most of the time, or what he gives away. He never lets his guard down, or seemingly never lets his guard down.
But he also manages to convey, as you say, very clearly, you can tell when he has the distrust, the because he is playing a game and he is putting up a front, a facade. There's politeness, but you can tell in the interactions that he has, for example, initially with Nadia, how he has no intention of trusting her at all, and the interactions he has with number two, you can see exactly what he thinks of number two and how within that kind of power game, where in theory number two should be the one with all of the power, in his performance McGoohan actually puts across just how much strength there is in number six, and how totally he is controlling the part that he is playing, or his character is playing within that situation.
I think he is always true to himself. I think that's what comes across in his character, is that he is. Anyway, there's several scenes in this one, but I mean, one of them which I adore is when he is in number two's office and they're having tea, and number two just tries, you know, how many lumps, sugar, one or two, and number six won't even tell him that. He's like, it's in the file, look it up. And he's like, well, it would save me time if I didn't have to look it up. I said, what, are you running out of time? And so number two looks up in the file, does not take sugar in his tea. There you see, we know all about this. And number three deliberately puts three cubes of sugar in his tea. Just, I mean, just that act of defiance. It's just funny.
It's great writing, but also McGoohan absolutely nails it. The way in which he gives those lines, you know, as you say when he now what was the line
on the tee about running out of time?
Yeah, you said it a minute.
Yeah, oh yeah, you're running out of time. Yeah.
Oh yes, you're running out of time, and it's such a clever line, but he delivers it in such a way, it's kind of, oh, do you think, you know, that's interesting? Or when number two says, you will crack in the end, and he says, oh, do you think so? And the lines are so light but so barbed and designed to needle number two, who is obviously this version of number two is this very kind of extrovert, apparently humorous character who kind of turns instantly and becomes very angry and frustrated. Mm-hmm. And you can see how quickly number six is to read that and to work out how to push his buttons and just how to needle him most effectively.
I think that's why they brought him back. The chemistry between the two of them on the screen really comes off as good. You know, it comes off as playful, but at the same time, McCarran has that sometimes uncontrolled rage underneath it when number six gets to him. And number six never cracks, but... It doesn't matter what scene they're in. There's always a little playback where number six is always trying to get information from number two, just in the same way that number six is trying, or number two is casually trying to get information from number six. They back and forth. So let's see. So this is his first great complicated escape plan. the building of the abstract piece of art. And to describe it for our listeners, it looks like he describes it, I think, as a church door. It's hollow, and you could pass through it like a portal. Then there's another piece that is like a barrier that's roughly the same shape. And then there's a cross piece. And if you put the barrier underneath the door frame and you put the cross piece up, you have a sailboat. And once he adds the tapestry that was one of the contest entries, then you have a sail with number two's face on it, which is a nice scene as he unfurls it and they head off into the night. There's a scene where all the other art, everything else in the place is number two. The chess pieces are number two. The clay busts are number two. The paintings are number two. Everything everyone's done is number two, except for number sixes, of course. And the judges don't understand it. But at one point, they even say, well, but what I don't understand is, where is number two? And you can tell that number two is trying to influence the judges. I mean, he's giving them clear hints that, you know, this is amazing. You really like this. So clearly, number six is going to win. And he gives this explanation about, you know, freedom and barriers. And there's a line where they said, well, why the cross? And that line was changed from the original script to the annoyance of the writer of this episode. The line said something to the, said, well, what is it? The cross, ultimately, it's faith. It's faith, it's knowledge, and ultimately, it's religion, is what the original line said, something to that effect. And McGoohan changed that line to, why not? And this was because McGoohan had that very strong Catholic thing going. He would not do the religious thing. And we talked about it a little bit last time. There is this, I don't want to say rumor, because it's relatively well established, but not 100% factual. It's factual, but it's not 100% locked in rule that McGoohan doesn't kiss on screen. But in this episode, he and Nadia were at one point, they're secretly plotting, and they're supposed to be sort of embracing and possibly kissing, although it doesn't really say in the original script, but they're clenching and talking to each other quietly. And McGoohan wouldn't do that as well. He backed it off too. He's just kind of, you know, gazing into her eyes and playing with her hair. These are all, you know, this man has his very, he has said in interviews that he just didn't want to do it because, not in this particular scene, but he just didn't want his kids seeing him kissing another woman on screen. But there are cases where McGoohan has kiss people in movies, and that's usually cited as, oh, that's BS. Here's a clip from this movie or something. But, you know, as a general rule, he avoids that. When he took the role of Danger Man, he basically said, you know, I want my character to be a very moral man. He will always use his brains before he'll use a gun, and he's not going to be kissing and using women in that way. So that was his bug, and he was the executive producer on the show, so he had a lot of control, along with George Markenstein, who quit through to creative differences at some point with him halfway.
It sounds like he didn't get on with
anybody.
A number of people.
You know, a lot of people said he was great drinking buddy and really a clever guy but you know, he was very strong minded, single minded when he came to his stuff. So, and undeniably he has put out something that has stood the test of time and still has people talking about it to this day. What stood out in the episode for you?
I did really, really enjoy this one. I absolutely loved it. And I mean, I did enjoy the first episode, but this one, I just found myself getting totally drawn into the episode. I was rather than thinking about it and making notes, I was just enjoying particularly the interplay between number six and number two. I just thought McKern was fantastic, and the whole intrigue, because at this stage you wonder, could things develop? Could he actually have escaped? Could he have got as far as London, and if so, what would happen next?
Did you think he got to London?
I have to say, I suspected not. Partly because, knowing the series, I knew that he would be in the village next week, and I couldn't see a way in which that could happen if he had actually escaped to London. But they made it because when he arrives in London, he is met by someone he recognises, and so it seems very difficult to explain how that could be if he's back amongst colleagues. How that could actually be the case if he isn't literally back in the offices of his old workplace. Although, of course, we discover that in fact Fotheringay is working for whoever number two is working for, whoever is number one, whichever side it is that's running the place.
As is the colonel, yeah, who he also recognises, so...
I wasn't clear whether he recognised the colonel or whether he knew who the colonel was.
I think he calls
him
by name first when he says he's Fotheringay colonel. So he must have known him as somebody. Now, in the cut lines from this episode, Fotheringay, when he's on the phone and says, "Yes, we got the cable," has an additional line that says, "Well, you know, something to the effect of, yes, I'm very much looking forward to him. He's not just a professional colleague. We went to school together." So there's a lot of history there with Fotheringay. And then on top of that, McGoohan requested this actor to play the part of Fotheringay because...
Richard Wattis.
Yeah. He also occasionally played his boss in Danger Man.
Ah.
I don't think he had that name, but he was, you know, there are these callbacks to that more classic spy program that he starred in for many years. It's hard for me to remember when I first saw this episode whether I was fooled by the trip to London. I kind of halfway may have been, but I just don't remember for sure. It's very well done. I mean, the one thing that disturbs me is that for this battle of wits, in which number six kind of wins, he did it by accident. He got lucky. He was right there about to tell them why he resigned, and it was just pure luck that guy had given him a bad timed watch.
Or it was bad preparation on their part. They insufficient attention to detail on their part.
Mm-hmm.
But also you could say someone who was less focused, less smart, would not have spotted it.
And probably, well, I don't know, maybe if all her constant references to Big Ben hadn't been going on, that he might not have been paying as much attention to it. But it's hard to say there. So does this mean that the village is run by the British because they've got so many high-ranking British people working for them?
I certainly don't think that's clear at this stage. I think one of the themes in this is... Because you do get a kind of very explicit discussion of the Cold War and the fact that as number two says, both sides are becoming identical. And he puts forward this idea that the village is what the whole world will become like when they realise they're looking in a mirror. So it doesn't actually matter which side it is. And I think one of the things that comes across for me in this, and also probably in certain other espionage serials of the time, is this sense that the spies and the spy masters are more similar to one another in a sense than they are different, because they're locked into a game where they're more or less obliged to play by the rules. And in a sense, this is the reality of the Cold War, because you have certain protocols or certain ways of doing things that become agreed, because it's, thinking of it purely from a game theoretical point of view, it's beneficial to both sides to do that. So you get exchanges of prisoners and this sort of thing. There are very clearly constrained and well-defined areas in which the actual conflict can occur. I mean, this is why it's a Cold War, of course. But in terms of that, you could have a member of the British Secret Service, the organisation for which presumably Number Six used to work, who is actually working for the opposition. And if it's the opposition who are behind the village, then they could call upon that person to come and play this role. So it could easily be the other side, and Fotheringay is an agent of the other side. So there is that possibility. And in a sense, what becomes more important in this episode is that it actually, regardless of who is running the village, when Number Six is facing down the colonel, he refuses to believe that the colonel doesn't know about the village. He doesn't accuse him of being behind it, but he accuses him of knowing about it, and in that sense having some complicity or collusion with what's going on, because he's part of keeping the secret.
And he also says something to the effect of, our side is better, isn't it? I have to believe that we're not like that. There was something to that effect in his line.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that comes across quite strongly in this episode, and it is one of the strengths and one of the things that I really enjoyed about the episode.
I was going to say, the other thing that we start to get him to explain his resignation, and I don't know that we need to go any further than what he actually says. It was a matter of conscience. You know, he starts to say, for a while now, I have beginning to feel that, and then that's when Big Ben tips him off. But he's clearly fed up with something, with something to do with the nature of his work, the job, what he stands for. And then that's, apparently that's not enough. But that seems to me like he's given us what his real reason was at that point.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly more to be said about that, though I don't imagine that we hear too much more about it, in the sense of, what was it that tipped him over into thinking that his conscience couldn't allow him to continue doing his job. Mm-hmm. But in terms of his character, in terms of what we need to know, I mean, I kind of said this last time, actually, from the point of view of just what we see within that very, very concentrated credit sequence, you get a real sense of the character of the man. So it's no surprise that his words in that scene, that they come as an affirmation of, I think, what I certainly felt I believed about that resignation, even if we don't know the details and even if we don't continue to find them.
Mm-hmm. He's fed up. I mean, he wouldn't be slamming into the desk and pounding his resignation down and storming out if he wasn't mad about something.
Indeed.
It could very well be the way they treated somebody, or it could be the way they did something, but it seems as if it's that question of, this is not the way that what I wish to be party of.
And it comes back to the fact that he believes that the colonel knows about the village. And so in some sense, it's no surprise to him that something as terrible as that should be known and suppressed by the people he was working for. So the level of disillusionment there, I think, has clearly become quite deeply ingrained.
So let me ask you a question. There is the scene where Fotheringay is on the phone before the prisoner arrives, and he's talking to someone, and he says, yes, we just got the cable, and I'm looking forward to seeing him. Why is he keeping up the pretense in a scene where the prisoner isn't?
That's an interesting question.
Let me
answer that question with another question, as politicians like to say. When number eight is swimming out to sea in what is apparently an escape attempt until Rover stops her, we see number two examining, or ostensibly examining, her file and discovering that she is a former international swimmer, mm-hmm. in a scene where the prisoner is not present.
Mm-hmm.
Why does he need to look that up?
That too. I think that's just to lead the audience astray.
It's kind of the opposite of dramatic irony, whatever we call that, where the characters know something and they're hoodwinking the audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... I suppose we could go so far... No, I don't think so. I was going to say maybe number two doesn't know that number eight is a plant at first. But he seems to go to an awful lot of trouble to get number six interested in her.
Yes,
her next,
I mean...
door, make sure that he's there when the helicopter arrives and that he sees it, calls him to the hospital when she's problems. He's definitely trying to bring the two together.
It's very hard to see that in any other way, because even from the beginning, where he makes sure that number six is watching the screen as she wakes up, in what he tells number six is a replica of her apartment, and she is obviously, as we know in retrospect, play acting at that point. But why would she be doing that if she didn't know that number two had it set up so that number six was the one witnessing what was going on there? That looking back in the context of what we end up discovering, that has to be a setup for number six's benefit.
True. And also, you have to give them credit. Their escape plan, where number six takes, you know, he wants to use his watch, and he's calculated how long this trip will take to get from Danzig to London, and, you know, the route by air, by road. So he's got it in his mind because he is checking it on his watch. That's why he wants the watch, because his watch is destroyed when they go into the sea. So he gets the Polish guy's watch because his is broken, and he's using that to time it to make sure that they really are traveling to London, which means that the people who set this up really spent a lot of effort to make sure that they could put him on a plane, fly him for the right length of time, drive him on a road the right length of time. It's very meticulous planning.
So one of the things that made me not absolutely certain that he was going to find himself in London was the fact that he spent such a long time, that they spent such a long time nailed into the crate, because there are obviously, shall we say, logistical considerations, unless you have extremely good control of your bladder for being in there for a very long time period. Now, there are good reasons why you would need to smuggle yourself past the Iron Curtain in a crate, but once you're on the other side, how long do you have to stay in the crate for? Once you've crossed into Western Europe, aren't you okay at that point? And certainly, once you're in London, do you need to be brought right into the office still inside the crate? There is
good
a
point.
Line in there saying, you know, if you stepped outside the office, you would be in danger. But from the point of view of at least convincing me that there could be a valid reason for that. That line came too late. I was already wondering, you know, why has he not been able to see out and see, you know, the real London, the outside London world? Because bringing him into the office in the crate makes it too easy to pull the wool over his eyes.
I would say that maybe we could argue that if he was traveling over land visible, that he might be more susceptible to the agents from the village to try to get him back. So, I mean, that could be the reason he's smuggling himself all the way to safety. But, yeah, they had a little bathroom in there. You can see it, but it was off to the corner. Or adult
diapers.
While
I'm picking at things, and I, as you say, I do love this one, but how long do you reckon it took him to carve that boat with his stone axe? How long do you reckon it took him to cut down the tree alone, never mind carving anything?
Well, at the beginning of the episode, they had 6 weeks. And when he had got it down and had the first piece kind of shaped, the archway piece kind of shaped, and number two came out to talk to him, he said, "You've only got 2 weeks left."
So we reckon that's 4 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it might have been a week before he started. I'm not sure, but it seemed to be a fairly short time from the arrival of number eight to the point where number six said he would join into the art exhibit. So, yeah, I think he spent weeks on it. I think they meant to convey that he'd spent weeks on it. It may not have shown up that well, but
I wasn't sure. It kind of made all that look quite easy when I wasn't sure that it could have been that easy.
But you got to give the man
the tools that he had.
You got to give the man credit for his ingenuity.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I did think it looked like a boat straight away, so I was quite surprised that the if indeed the judges at the exhibition didn't realise that it was a boat, that they could possibly have missed that fact. It looked like a boat. Whether it would actually sail like a boat, particularly given the fact that it didn't have a centre plate, so it would be unable to steer and would just be blown whichever way the wind was going.
Are you going to bring up your superior knowledge of regattas here, aren't you?
Well, I just didn't think that it could go in any other direction than the direction the wind was blowing, which, you know, maybe it was just blowing in the right way towards where the guy was waiting for them with his rifle. So, you know, that would be very convenient, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, I don't know enough about sailing. It looked a bit like a boat to me as well. But I think the scene where he's showing the bottom piece, and it's a barrier, and it's got two big holes in it, so he can poke his head through it and, you know, look at them through it. So you're thinking, well, if it is a boat, it's kind of got two major structural problems. But I guess he uses a tarp to hold the pieces together and watertight it. I think that's what we see.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that certainly seems sound. Mm-hmm. I did think all I loved having the way in which he bought the sail with the image of number two on it. And the image of number two, I don't know if I'm reading too much into this, but there are obviously Orwellian echoes in the village, what with the fact that everyone is constantly under surveillance, and you have this these announcements coming through the speakers everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I did think there were a few other things in this that also, I mean, one of them was having the image of number two everywhere in that craft exhibition. But there was also the way in which he was drawn. The effort to find out what they wanted to know from him was based on getting him to trust someone,
mm-hmm.
who he then ended up betraying, because obviously one of the things you picked up was the fact that he was on the verge of explaining himself and saying why he resigned before he realised the trick, but before that, he actually completely sold out Nadia, who he hadn't at that point realised was not genuine. He's mm-hmm. still he still believed in her, but he gave away almost instantly and trustingly who she was, what her name was, and who, at least he believed, she was working for. Everything she told him, in fact.
Mm-hmm. So, but he did bargain for her safety.
He thought he'd bargained for her safety, but the fact of the matter was, and I as a viewer at that point, I did not realise that she was complicit in that, because it could easily have been the case that she had been fed whatever story they needed her to have in order to play this role, and that they had manipulated her in order to bring her close to number six. Mm-hmm. And so she could quite genuinely have been in that position, and yet everything she gave him, the fact that she had worked out where the village was and who she was working for, all the things that she had told him in secret, whispering so that they wouldn't be able to overhear, he told them directly and willingly, albeit he didn't actually realise what he was doing, but he told them out loud what she had said to him. So, in effect, he was actually betraying her.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, earlier in the episode, she does ask him, you know, will you take me with you? Can you protect me? Will you give me your word? And he did say, you know, I'll give you my word for what that's worth. But, you know, I think he was implying, I can't speak for what the English authorities will do when we get there.
But it's his actions that give her away. I mean, obviously, in fact, he's not giving her away because she's not for real. But, you know, he realizes the mistake he's made before he gives himself away, but after, as far as he is concerned, he's already given her away.
Well, I think that shows that he just was totally, he totally trusted him. He trusted his own guys. Never again, obviously, from this point forward. But anyway, I don't know that I have anything else on this episode. It's a very entertaining episode.
Yes.
I think it's one of the ones that makes it stand out. Now, one thing I didn't mention, I don't think I mentioned it. Originally, The Prisoner was supposed to be 6 or 7 episodes long. That's what McGoohan had in mind. And
really?
Yeah, and I think probably Lou Grade came to him and said, look, we're having trouble selling this. Normally we need like 24. Can you do 24? And I think they sat down and they worked out some stuff, and they came back and said, we can do 17. And so there's an expanded group of episodes that were done for this series. However, subsequently, McGoohan has said, there are 7 episodes of The Prisoner that I would line up back to back, and that's the story. And the others, he would chuck. This is one of the original 7 in the story arc. If it's not exactly an arc, that's the wrong choice of the word. And I kind of disagree with him, because there are some of those other episodes which I think are excellent examples of Prisoner. But there are A stories and there are B stories as far as McGoohan is considered. So
is that why it only ran to 17 episodes in total? Because it was never intended to even run to as many as that.
Right. That was their compromise with Lou Grade, so that they could get the show made. So I'll poke around and make sure that I figure out which ones are the 7 episodes, so that we can mention it as we go through them, whether these are the extra episodes that aren't needed or these are the episodes that are needed. That might be interesting. I'm pretty sure the next one, A, B, and C, is also one of the original episodes. And it's also a fascinating one. I love that episode too. So this is very few that I don't love of The Prisoner. A couple of them are.
Well, I'm certainly enjoying it a great deal. I mean, like I say, nothing wrong with the first episode, but this was a cracker. More of this, I should be very happy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure as always.
We'll probably have you back on real soon. Maybe talking about another episode of Prisoner real soon.
I look forward to it.
All right. And we hope you all will join us again next time on Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production.
Like us, leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit at our website, FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Search for Fusion Patrol. Or just drop us a note at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolfe.